Welcome to Old Man Sailing, the podcast. This is John Passmore, and I'm speaking to you from Prickly Bay in the south coast of Grenada. It's an appropriate place to record this because the first item is getting stuck in Dublin. If you're going to get stuck somewhere, Dublin is a pretty good place to do it. The plan had been to stay for a day or two while the Isle of Man TT was rained off. I could do the Guinness tour, listen to some Irish music in the pubs, drink some more Guinness. Who cared if it rained? But then, just as I furled the jib as the wind picked up in Dublin Bay, the sheet flipped the whole of the top of the winch onto the deck. How did that happen? The top of the winch is supposed to be held down by a plastic disc which screws into the feeder arm and holds the whole thing together. There you are. Isn't that impressive? I know that the silver bit is called the feeder arm. That's because I had to scour the internet to find out what I needed to ask for when ringing round the local chandleries for a replacement. Because, you see, when both the feeder arm and the top cap left off the winch and bounced onto the side deck, the top cap bounced higher and straight over the side. It was one of those moments when you freeze to see what is going to happen and later on wish you were the sort of person who doesn't freeze in emergencies but leaps into action, in this case snatching the bits out of the air like the second slip at Lord's. Instead, of course, I stood mesmerised as the feeder arm, being the heavier of the two, landed in the scuppers, while the tiny, lightweight top cap arced delicately over the guardrails and into the boiling maelstrom, which is Dublin Bay in a southerly 4-7. Now, I suppose it would have been possible to sail back to the Isle of Man for the last of the TT without the starboard cockpit winch, and, of course, it would certainly be possible if I had a posh boat with secondary winches. But as things stood, I really couldn't think of anything more inconvenient. Would switching the top cap from the port winch every time I went about be more trouble than rigging a handy billy on the sheet? Simpler to wait till Monday morning and ring round the chandleries for another. Except, for some reason I never established, Monday was a bank holiday in the Republic of Ireland, although not in the UK. What if I got to Tuesday and nobody had one? And wouldn't even sell me one off the winch in the window, which of course would make their £800 item out of stock and totally unsaleable until they got a new top cap. In the end, I ordered one from the UK. They'd get it in the post right away. It should arrive on Wednesday. If I left on Wednesday evening, I could be back in the Isle of Man by Thursday night, still in time for the last day of the TT on Friday. Anyway, there didn't seem to be an alternative. Odd how things turn out. Once the package was in the post, I stopped worrying. In fact, those 4 days in Dublin were just great. I did the Guinness tour. Actually, I did it twice, because I was just about to collect my pint when a very insistent and annoying announcement over the public address system kept demanding a Mr. Sands presence in reception, which turned out to be a code for a fire alarm. Still, I got my pint in the end. You get to look forward to it after going round the tour twice. Do you know how to pour a Guinness? There's a right way and a wrong way. It's all to do with the proportion of carbon dioxide and nitrogen you put in the glass along with the beer. Anyway, I messed up mine by trying to put in too much Guinness and it went slopping all down the side. I joined a party of Americans and Canadians for a musical pub crawl round the Temple Bar. The lone Englishman. I was quite the celebrity. "Welcome to Europe," said the guide. In those 4 days, I rode my little folding bicycle all over the city. The Yeats exhibition, backwards and forwards across Halfpenny Bridge, St. Stephen's Green was an eye-opener with all its signs telling the story of the Easter Rising. Here was the spot where the Irish Citizen Army dug their trenches and pinched cushions from the cars parked in the adjoining streets to make themselves comfortable. And there, on the facade of the Royal College of Surgeons, were the scars of the British Army's Lewis gun firing out of the bedroom window on the fourth floor of the Shelbourne Hotel. Of course, both sides agreed a truce when it was time for the park keeper to feed the ducks. I didn't know any of this, but then I went to school in England. I wouldn't, which of course explains half a century of misery on both sides. Meanwhile, everywhere you go in Dublin there are pubs and there is music. In fact, the music spills out onto the street. It seems that on every corner there is someone with a guitar, and next to the statue of Molly Malone, a proper setup with a microphone and speakers and a duo leading the tourists in endless repetitions of She Wheeled Her Wheelbarrow. Molly, by the way, was quite a gal, if her statue is anything to go by. Her bosom positively gleams, lovingly polished by the groping hands of 10 million tourists a year. When Wednesday came and went with no sign of a small package for me behind the bar of the Polbeg Yacht and Boat Club, I was really quite philosophical. I think I ordered another Guinness to make up for it, but then it was too late for the TT. When it did arrive on Thursday, I set off back across the Irish Sea to Wales. There was to be a free mooring for a week at Pwllheli in preparation for the Jester Challenge. More about that next time. In praise of the humble clothes peg. I think it is time for praise where it's due. Out of all the myriad items on a boat, from duct tape to bits of string with loops in one end, what do you think wins the prize for the greatest number of random but totally brilliant alternative uses? Okay, so I've just used duct tape to block up the holes in the spinnaker pole to stop it filling up with water and emptying all over my sleeve, and currently there are no fewer than 6 bits of string holding back the halyards. But you expect that. What I find so extraordinary is the apparently endless uses on a boat for that most humble domestic item, the clothes peg, or as the Americans would have it, the clothes pin. They cost almost nothing, and yet they seem capable of anything. I would be most interested if anyone can suggest even more unexpected uses, but to date, this is what I have. 1. A peg marked inlet closed gets clipped to the ignition key to stop me starting the engine and blowing it up for want of cooling water. 2. Another says shore power and stops me leaving the marina and taking the electricity point with me. Apparently it does happen more often than you would expect. 3. A third clothes peg goes on the key when the battery selector is switched to starting. In the past I have nodded approvingly about the amount the solar panel was pushing into the service bank without realizing it. That it was the starting battery that was still selected and rapidly going flat. 4. Of course, there are always half a dozen pegs closing plastic bags in the galley. 5. The spring in the peg works brilliantly for holding the companionway lock open when you close it from the outside. The peg just drops off the inside. 6. Take a peg to pieces, and the two halves make very effective wedges to stop the washboards rattling in a seaway. 7. When the fridge is switched off, a peg in the door holds it open against a loop of shock cord to allow the air to circulate and stop the mould growing. 8. And of course, you can always use them for the laundry. By the way, Simon Curran, who is at that time the Commodore of the Ocean Cruising Club, responded by saying that he uses clothes pegs as spacers between the SSB aerial and the backstay. The Zone. This is a cautionary tale. It is mostly for my benefit. I should begin by telling you that even though I am writing this sitting on the lee berth while tacking laboriously along the south coast of Ireland in the vague direction of Baltimore, I have my phone beside me with the timer set for 20 minutes. Well, actually 15 minutes 45 seconds, because it has taken me 4 minutes and 15 seconds to work that out and write it down. This is important, because the more I think about what I'm writing, the less I think about where I'm going. And at the moment, I'm sailing at 4 knots in the direction of a French fishing boat called A la Garde de Dieu. I know this, and also that the Frenchman is doing 3.7 knots, so obviously he's trawling, which in turn means that everything else, absolutely everything else, from a supertanker to the lifeboat, and most definitely me and my little boat, all have to give way to him. There is also a good reason for this. Once a fishing boat has its nets down, it can't stop, and it can't alter course. In fact, with all that lot hanging off the back, the rudder doesn't work at all. I know all about La Garde de Dieu because she shows up as an AIS target on the plotter, a little green triangle that I can click to find the ship's name, course and speed, everything down to her destination, fishing grounds. The Frenchman is 4 miles away. I have been able to pick him out with the binoculars, and if the wind holds, I should pass comfortably ahead of him. All the same, I set the timer because I have the laptop on my knees and I'm writing it all down. And, as every writer will know, this is when you are at your most vulnerable. I used to write for a living. In fact, I have spent more than 50 years writing. At my busiest, Fleet Street, in the 1980s and 90s, I could churn out 600 words an hour, very often dictating off the top of my head directly down the telephone. It was wonderful when they invented mobile phones and you could stride about while composing instead of being imprisoned in a smelly phone box while people tapped on the door with 10-pence pieces and said, "You're going to be much longer." Of course, I ignored them because I was in the zone. In other words, the outside world had ceased to exist. There were only the words. And that is how it was about this time yesterday. Somewhere in the middle of St. George's Channel, as I sat in the same spot, a new book up on the screen, and the words clattering out, I still think of them as clattering, as if this was my trusty brother portable, the one held together with twisted paper clips, even though now the tiny plastic Asus makes about as much noise as a mouse picking its teeth. Heaven knows how long this had been going on, which is the worrying part. If, instead of being all productive, I had settled down to sleep, I would have set the timers, 2 of them on different phones with different ringtones. Somehow, if you are going to close your eyes deliberately, the idea of being woken up to stop yourself running into anything seems terribly important. On the other hand, if you are awake already, surely you don't need an alarm. But what if the words have taken you somewhere else, a place where there is only imagination and time has no meaning? An hour must have passed. It didn't seem like it. Then I swear somebody said, "Samsara." Only that, nothing else. It was such a brief distraction that I was tempted to ignore it. I had just had the most brilliant idea and was keen to get it down before it slipped away. That's the way it is with brilliant ideas. You have to pin them down before they flutter off and bother someone else. However, most definitely somebody had said samsara. Surely that must demand a moment's attention, at the very least. I cut loose a couple of brain cells to investigate while flailing clumsily after the brilliant idea. The brain cells reported back diffidently so as not to disturb the creative flow. There was only one possible explanation. Since I was alone on the boat, the voice must have come from the VHF radio. Usually this box of tricks remains silent, only waking up every 3 hours for Dublin and Minehead Coast Guards to issue their maritime safety broadcast. Sometimes watch officers on the bridges of container ships would discuss how not to hit each other, and of course, Irish lifeboats whiz about all the time, chattering like teenagers on skateboards. But now someone was calling me. I plucked the microphone from its clip. "Station calling Samsara, say again." But all they said was, "Channel 10. I switched to Channel 10. "Station calling Samsara, say again." And then this charming Irish voice oozed out of the speaker. "I was just wondering, what were your intentions?" What were my intentions? Why did he want to know about my intentions? My intentions were to get back to the laptop and that brilliant idea, whatever it was. Already it had one foot on the doorstep. I poked my head out of the hatch, and there, no more than 300 meters away, was a great, big, bright blue fishing boat, bashing straight into the wind and sea, sending clouds of spray flying back over the wheelhouse. And if it carried on doing that, and I carried on with my 4 knots for Baltimore, we would meet in the same patch of water in about, 1.5 minutes. Thumbing the TX button, I suggested, "I'll turn to port," and did, very snappily indeed. For the next half hour, as our courses diverged, I made a succession of resolutions about setting the timers whenever there was even the slightest possibility of finding myself in the zone. And then, as the big blue fishing boat receded to a dot on the horizon, the thought occurred that he had not appeared on the plotter. If he had, the alarm would have gone off. But the screen was blank. It was still blank, meaning that his AIS beacon must have been switched off. Or, as they say when talking about Iranian tankers supplying Syria, he was cloaked. Now, why would a fishing boat do that? The obvious conclusion was that he didn't want anyone to know he was there, not, for instance, the fishery inspectors, or possibly his competition. There could be any number of reasons why a fishing boat might want to remain invisible. And, of course, that would explain why he had not identified himself when he called me on Channel 16. The Coast Guard monitor Channel 16. Come to that, everyone monitors Channel 16, including fishery inspectors and other fishing boats. I began to feel a little better. If I was at fault for not keeping a lookout, then he was equally at fault for trying to disappear. And if you think that, given the length of this explanation for what was, after all, only a couple of minutes of activity, albeit somewhat feverish activity, and you suspect that I have again fallen into the zone, you are absolutely right. But take heart. By now it is Sunday afternoon. I am anchored in Baltimore Harbor. The wind is making mournful noises in the rigging, and the rain is going sideways past the windows. If I could bring myself to look out of them. Actually, the zone is the better place to be. As I said, I'm recording this in Prickly Bay in Grenada, at 3:30 in the morning, if you must know. I woke up with rain falling on me through the central hatch, and then thought I might as well get up and do something useful. It's been a day of doing useful things. Rebedding two deck fittings on the foredeck, replacing the U-bolt for the spinnaker block, which broke under the weight of the Super Zero, the new supposedly lightweight headsail. In fact, the boat has just undergone a mini refit to repair the rest of the damage left over from the knockdown on the way to the Canaries. She came out of the water while I went home for the annual family skiing holiday. We tried Andorra for the first time because my youngest, Hugo, had been there with his university ski club and said it wasn't at all limited and suited only to beginners. We always ski at Easter, which means that I celebrate my birthday in the mountains, and for the past 5 years there has been a tradition that Hugo films me skiing, and I put it in the Old Man Sailing YouTube channel under the heading of Skiing on 70-year-old knees, skiing on 71-year-old knees, and so on. This year, it was skiing on 75-year-old knees, and comparing my style to previous years, I think I can say that my knees are a fine advertisement for the health supplement, which I recommend on the Good Health page of the blog. Because if you want to keep sailing, you do need to look after your knees. So do go and inspect oldmansailing.com/good-health. Stuck in the mud. It seems only yesterday that I wrote with such pride about pulling up the anchor by hand, and me 70 years old if I'm a day. Imagine how impressive it will be when I'm 80. You might have guessed that I would live to regret this. But from Falmouth to the Hebrides, the Isle of Man and North Wales, I have hauled up the 20-kilo Rückner on its 10-millimeter chain as if it was no more than a bath plug. Even in the dark depths of Loch Spelve, I got it up in the end. Then I dropped it in Baltimore, the Irish one. Baltimore is this year's destination for the Jester Challenge, and the other single-handers in small boats turned out to be such a convivial crowd, and Bush's bar served such a good pint of Guinness that I stayed for a week. Part of that week involved the gale which battered the Azores and back fleet on their return to Plymouth. One way and another, when the time came to weigh anchor and head back to the UK, it was well dug in. In fact, it was so well dug in that after an hour of grunting and revving and nothing to show for it, the only possible explanation had to be that something had fouled it. I knew all about fouled anchors. This time last year in the Outer Hebrides, I had to call out a diver to get the thing out from under a ground chain. And this felt just the same. The identical, absolute, rock-solid resistance. I'll tell you the moral of this story now. Don't make assumptions. Check your facts before shelling out for another diver, particularly since they cost twice as much in Baltimore as they do in Barra. This time, the assumption was that just because the anchor wouldn't budge, it must be fouled again. I now realize that I was predisposed to think this way, because now I have the answer. After last year's debacle, I bought myself an anchor rescue. This is a brilliant bit of kit, made in America by Scanmar. One half of it lives permanently on the chain, and the other half goes down on the tripping line to connect to it. The clever thing is that you do this after the event, because as Sod's Law dictates, the time your anchor gets fouled is the time you didn't think to rig a tripping line. With a bit of jiggling, I got the two halves connected, at which point, according to the instructions, using a hand-over-hand technique, raised the retriever without relying on the windlass or capstan until the anchor is free of the bottom. Of course, I didn't read that bit. Who bothers to read instructions when they're trying out something as exciting as this? I did get around to reading them later, after it turned out that the anchor didn't want to come out backwards either, even though I put the line on the cockpit winch and cranked until it hummed. That was when I decided to look up the braking strain. 760 pounds. What's this, about 350? I plucked the line as if it were a violin string. Maybe not. So, in the end, Jerry the diver went down and tied another line to the roll bar. Then I winched on that while he mud-wrestled on the bottom. Afterwards, he reckoned that even if I had possessed a working windlass, it wouldn't have done any good. Nothing short of a commercial tug for Baltimore mud, apparently. So, here's the practical part. This is what I should have done, in case you happen to visit Baltimore at the same time as a vigorous low. Go and ask the harbour master if there is anything down there that could foul an anchor. Maybe he'll say the local mud does that. 2. Get in the water and look at it. Being a born and bred East Coast sailor, it never occurred to me that all I had to do was dive down a couple of meters and I would have been able to see what was going on. 3. And this is the big one. Don't be in such a hurry. Wait for low water. Haul the chain as tight as it will go, and then wait for high water. With a range of 2 meters, there is no mud in the world that can compete with the buoyancy of Samsara's great fat bow. I really wish I had thought of that one. I once read a description of a Thames barge being held down by the suction of an East Coast mud bank as the tide rose higher and higher at its topsides. Eventually, as the water began to lap at the scuppers and it seemed the ship must founder, there was a tremendous explosion of mud, water, and air. And the old lady shot to the surface, and then apparently kept going. Also, if I hadn't given Jerry €100, I could have had dinner at the Muse Restaurant, Baltimore's celebrated foodie heaven. Although maybe €100 wouldn't go that far. Not when they start you off with mackerel tartare dotted with charred gooseberry slices, wood sorrel and day-glow orange nasturtium petals. Alternatively, I could just get the windlass fixed. When I was 55, I found myself without a job and discovered that at 55, they don't give you another one. Someone showed me what I'm about to show you, and by the time I was 68, I was able to buy a boat and retire onto it. Then, 2 years ago, my wife wanted to downsize, and we tried to sell the house. We found I had made an appallingly bad decision in signing a contract without getting a lawyer to check it first. We lost an embarrassingly large amount of money. Now I am on a mission to recoup that over the next 5 years. Every day I spend an hour asking people if I can show them what I do. It takes 5 minutes. If this idea appeals to you and you live in the UK, then do get in touch. The last podcast featured Largo's O-Star, that is the single-handed transatlantic race of 1988. That was what I wrote for the Evening Standard, but then, of course, I had to write it all over again for Yachting Monthly. It appears that this happened quite a lot, this retelling of the same story again and again. I wondered whether I should engage in some judicious editing now that it is all being put together in one book. Well, two books, if you're going to be pedantic. But I like to think that each time I told a story, I gave it a new twist. And anyway, it is an old man's prerogative to go on and on. The canapes were wedged in the sink. A bottle of champagne stood cooling in a bucket of Atlantic by the chart table, and I comforted myself that no one was likely to notice that I wasn't wearing cufflinks. There are, after all, some advantages to giving a party 800 miles out in the Carlsberg single-handed transatlantic race. The invitations had gone out after Portishead Radio's 1100 hours weather bulletin, in tones that might have done equally well for a vigorous low moving quickly east. The operator explained, "Competitors might like to know that James Hatfield of Largo has been awarded the MBE in the birthday honours. Anyone who would like to congratulate him will find him on 4143.5 MHz at 1900 GMT. Like the weather, this was true in parts. James had been awarded the MBE for raising money for charity while sailing alone around the world. He would most certainly be coming up on the single sideband schedule when a bunch of us met up on 4243.5, three times a day. It was just that his boat was called British Heart 3. I was sailing Largo. And that was how I came to host the oddest, most memorable, and certainly the most enjoyable party I have ever given, even if none of the guests actually met. We were, at this stage, spread out over hundreds of square miles of ocean. But after a week alone at sea, during which the only human contact had been over the radio, the idea of us being separated by distance seemed somehow to have got lost along the way. So there seemed nothing odd at 1900, sitting by the set, tweaking at the cuffs of a ridiculous white silk dinner jacket, and trying to stop the champagne sliding all over the floor. Robin Knox Johnson was the first to arrive, his voice coming over crisp and clear from somewhere 300 miles to the south. He brought a bottle of Cutty Sark, but had been tinkering with Sue Haley's engine all day and hadn't had time to change. I told him to go through to the drawing room where people wearing frilly aprons were handing round canapes. James Hatfield, the guest of honour, was next, and full of apologies. He said he'd had terrible trouble getting a cab. Others arrived. Ari Wieg, being Norwegian, thought that the MBE was some sort of prize. I attempted to transmit the sound of a champagne cork popping and dropped the microphone. It bounced tantalisingly on the edge of the bucket before I grabbed it and spilled a mixture of champagne and seawater all over my feet. James ran off with one of the people in frilly aprons. It was only afterwards that it dawned on me that we had proved that single-handed races are not nearly as lonely as everyone seems to imagine. Start painting numbers on the deck and hang an Aries off the back, and immediately a small crowd gathers on the pontoon asking, "Why do you do it, and don't you get lonely?" People on neighbouring boats tell each other quietly, "He always was a loner." Listen to the rest of the world, and you'd imagine that we couldn't wait to get away from the whole lot of them, and that the social side of life in Plymouth consists of 96 people standing on their own in the Carlsberg tent, staring into their beer and wondering how soon they can decently slip away. But in fact, the embarrassingly named Atlantic Challenger Bar was heaving every evening. Parties started on boats for no better reason than someone came asking to borrow a hacksaw, and there happened to be a beer open. The restaurants of the Barbican set new records for accepting bookings for two, and then having to push tables together to accommodate six. For the plain fact is that solo sailors are not a breed apart. There is not something different in their characters which makes them incapable of relating to the rest of the world. Those sort of people slip quietly from their moorings on a Friday night without a word to a soul, and are next heard of in Panama. In fact, most of the sailors in races like the Carlsberg and the Azorsenback do it for the company. I didn't realize any of this at the time, of course. It never occurred to me that our little party was the highlight of the evening for plenty of others who couldn't be there because they only had single sideband receivers. It wasn't until we got to Newport and discovered that all sorts of unlikely people were acquainted with our sense of humour that we began to realise just how important the radio schedule had been for everyone. Peter Keeg in Zeal called it Hatfield's half hour, and certainly the dialogue did owe something to the vintage radio comedy. British Heart. Morning, Largo, how are you? Largo. Terrible. The boat's in a frightful mess. What with Nigel throwing Charlotte Russe all over the ballroom and the band getting drunk and pushing the grand piano in the swimming pool. By the way, the caterers say they're missing a person in a frilly apron. You haven't got one, have you? British Heart. Yes, she's here, although she hasn't got her apron on anymore. By the way, can I have my lawnmower back? Largo. That went in the swimming pool too. British Heart. Damn, the polo ponies don't like it if the grass gets too long. How's Nigel? Piper Rising, this is British Heart. Piper Rising. Hi, James. I'm fine, but I got stopped by the police for driving through a high-pressure zone without due care and attention. Sorry to hear Largo's in a mess. Shall I send the maid over to clean up? Eventually, of course, we returned to discussing our progress, but even that consisted of such rubbish as British Heart. Soren Sophie, where are you this morning? Soren Sophie. Hello, James. I have now reached 48 degrees west. I am at 4801 west, 3112 north. Where are you today? British Heart. I'm where you were yesterday in a bloody mess you left the place in too. Of course, not everyone appreciated that sort of thing. The magnificent Frenchman Francois Bourgeois made his clear in Plymouth when I told him I had an SSB. With such a radio, he growled, you are not truly alone. You will not find such a radio on my boat. I looked at his boat, a beautiful 36-footer called Safar. I classed her in the dependable sea boat category. However, he was quite right. She had no aerials. But surely the rules demanded a VHF. Francois nodded gravely. And held, he said, holding up a hand. One watt and two channels. I have a range of 1 mile, but I do not use it. I felt it best not to tell him about my experience on the Azab when I had only VHF and how I switched on every evening and begged, is anyone there? After the Solent at a weekend, the idea of not finding anyone listening within a 20-mile radius takes some getting used to. But it is remarkable how quickly you do end up on your own. In that race, I talked to a fellow competitor off Ushant, and then not again until I was in sight of the island of San Miguel 10 days later. So, one tends to rely on passing shipping for conversation. That is probably because a £250,000 bulk carrier is easier to see on the horizon than another 32-foot yacht, and it's only when you see something that you think to call them. Although, of course, in the beginning, I didn't presume to do anything of the kind. It only started after I'd left the VHF switched on after my plaintive Is There Anyone There session of the night before, so I was rather startled to hear someone whistle at me from the cabin. The first thought, of course, was that this was an hallucination. I had, after all, been expecting one. All solo sailors worth their salt hope to experience their own version of Slocum's Pilot of the Pinta appearing at the helm. The only trouble was that I had not been battling a gale for 3 days without a rest. I had not eaten goat's cheese and plums, and I doubted that even peanut butter and honey sandwiches would produce the same effect. It took me a ridiculously long time to realize there was no point in looking in the boat for the Phantom Whistler, and once I thought to scan the horizon, there, passing at a companionable 3 miles, was a rusty freighter. Not knowing quite how to call up a total stranger, I plucked the microphone from its bracket and whistled back. This time I got a voice. "Hello, sailing boat." He turned out to be a Greek-registered motor vessel in ballast from Leningrad to Charlestown to pick up grain. We had a long chat. He was so impressed to hear about the race and the fact that I was alone, he even went to get his captain, and I had to explain it all over again. Quite made my day. Of course, merchant seamen tend to get rather bored and are only too happy to chat. The trouble is that, for the yachtsman, after the first half dozen miles, the novelty begins to wear off. Even the most troublesome ego can get enough of the incredulous, "You mean you are alone? You have no crew? There is no one else aboard your ship?" Much more fun was running into a Swede slap in the middle of the Atlantic. We only ran into each other metaphorically, of course. Actually, we never saw each other at all. But he had a yacht in sight and was trying to make contact, while I was over the horizon with the VHF switched on. I soon discovered why the Swede had been so anxious to talk. He was in a virtue and had set out from Venezuela intending to stop in the Caribbean on his way home, but when he got to the right latitude he found he was enjoying himself so much he decided to keep going. So instead he headed for the Azores. But after a few days that seemed a pointless detour too, and now he was plodding straight up the middle of the Atlantic with the vague idea of calling at the Faroe Islands. Since he didn't have a chart of the area, and I thoroughly frightened him with an account I'd read somewhere of the 10-knot tides between the islands, he decided not to go there either. Besides, he was getting to like the idea of doing Venezuela to Sweden non-stop. We chatted for an hour until I got hungry, and then after dinner he called again, saying he would like me to send a telegram to his mother after all. Personally, I think he just wanted to talk some more, so we covered the state of his clothes, going rather mouldy, and my bean sprouts, which had somehow managed to spill all over the cabin and were now growing in some very peculiar places indeed. We didn't say goodbye until the transmissions started breaking up. It was odd, really, that we found so much to talk about. In my weekly calls home, I was becoming progressively tongue-tied. It seemed ridiculous to go on about the weather, although out there the weather was the single most important part of life. Meanwhile, news of goings-on ashore seemed to lack something in the way of reality. Up until then, I had been setting 2 alarm clocks so that I woke up every 40 minutes for a look around. I know it's technically possible for a ship to appear over the horizon and run down a yacht in 30 minutes, but for that they both have to be heading straight for each other and both going at full speed. And if I was going to be that unlucky, then the floating container would get me anyway. So there I was, crawling out of bed all the time and still only seeing ships at the rate of 1 every 3 or 4 days, when I discovered that I was the only one daft enough to do this. As an experiment, I set the alarm just once for 90 minutes. It was wonderful. It was like a lie-in on a Sunday morning, knowing that someone else is getting breakfast. I slept soundly for an hour. And then, would you believe it, the watchman radar detector went off. This usually heralds a ship about 3 miles away. I grumbled, spent a minute getting myself up and putting on my shoes. Slowly I hauled myself into the companionway. And there, about 100 feet away, was the biggest trawler I had ever seen. I knew very well that small ships' radars failed to set off the watchman until the last minute, but what was a trawler doing here? He should be on the Grand Banks. I was prepared to stay awake practically round the clock when I got there. But there he was, ablaze with lights, churning along at a steady 5 knots with his engines straining. everything else on the ocean would get out of his way for the very good reason that with everything he was dragging behind him, his rudder wouldn't have any effect anyway. I stood there and stared at him and felt sick and dizzy. There was no point in going about now that he was past me, and anyway, there was less chance of fouling his cables if I kept the boat heeled. All I could think about was that we were steering by Aries, and how the tiniest shift of wind would have put us under his bow instead of his stern. Of course, I had no trouble staying awake after that. I paced from the chart table to the galley, and then turned round and took one pace back again, because that's all the room there was, and every 10 paces I leapt onto the step and scanned the horizon. Nothing. I realized after a while that this was ridiculous. I switched on the radio. I was just beginning to hear the Newfoundland medium-wave station during the hours of darkness, but since this was 3 o'clock in the morning, and even Newfoundlanders don't provide much of a radio audience at 3 o'clock in the morning, we had the Minority Interest show. At that moment, I would have been happy with a talk about goat breeding or English for new Canadians. What I got was a man with a Georgia accent telling me, "You turned away from God," and he pronounced it God. "Who, me?" "Yes, you. You turned your back on him." It was awful. There was this ghastly man who probably had a white suit covered in rhinestones and a $1 billion mission, and he had me exactly where he wanted me. And since he put it like that, yes, I did prefer to go sailing on Sundays. But he wouldn't let go. And I, who knew with great certainty that I was only alive by the merest chance, was quite unable to switch him off. He harangued me for 10 minutes before he got me down on my knees. I felt ridiculous, but more than that, I felt very frightened indeed. In the morning, I just felt ridiculous. I certainly wasn't going to write about this. I'd have every religious nut in London after me. In fact, it wasn't until I got my feet on solid ground again and the office demanded a final article that I wrote about it. They wanted an analysis of my state of mind. The headline was already written. It said, "Did I go mad?" So I sat there looking out over a Massachusetts cornfield and set up the little portable computer that had travelled all the way in the dry food locker, took a deep breath and decided that this too was part of the whole adventure. Of course, I told them that I didn't go mad. I told them that I wanted to do it again, and that the next time I heard the dolphins talking to me through the hull, I would bound up on deck once more, calling a welcome. I made a reasoned case that the oceans were made to be sailed and the sun and the wind come free, and I suggested that all of this was a good deal more sane than much of what goes on to make up the news bulletins I had left behind. But that wasn't what convinced them. In the end, it was a rather shaky photograph taken 800 miles out with the camera clamped to the rail, which did the trick. You see, I really did wear that awful white silk dinner jacket.